afternoon session with another one of the Medicine Made Ridiculously Simple talks. You guys had one this morning, but I'll remind you that these talks come from a competition for our fellow trainees in the Department of Medicine. The trainees are challenged to present a controversial or confusing topic from the field of medicine in a short, clear, 10-minute summary, and we've asked some of our presenters from last year's competition. And right now I'd like to introduce Dr. Niall Prendergast from Pulmonary. Thank you, Niall.
Hello, everyone. I'm Niall Prendergast. No worries, it happens all the time. I'm one of the pulmonary critical care fellows, and I'm here to update you in pulmonary medicine. I will say, as a disclaimer, my competition presentation was very different from this one. That one was on mechanical ventilation, which I felt was inappropriate for this audience. So instead, I'm going to talk to you about updates in COPD. So anyone here take care of COPD? Excellent. Me too. I'll start, as is tradition, with a case. So a husband and wife pair come into your office. They're both, for the sake of argument, 65. The husband is dyspneic all the time. He's pretty obstructed. He has a bad diffusion limitation. He's been on oxygen for a couple of years. He hasn't been to the hospital, really. He just can't do anything. His wife, on the other hand, also obstructed, gas exchange relatively preserved. She's not on oxygen, but she's coughing. She's coughing up a lot of sputum. She gets admitted to the hospital a couple of times a year. They're both on appropriate therapy. They're on Stiolto, Mometasone, or Symbicort, Spiriva, whatever your preferred cocktail is. They get their vaccinations. They've gone to pulmonary rehab. But they want to know what else they can do. That's what I'm here to talk about. Because there are a couple of advances that have come forward in the last 10 years. So a bit about COPD, obviously it's prevalent and morbid. There are 12 million adults known to have it. The true number is probably closer to 20. It accounts for about $50 billion in healthcare spending in the United States. And it's the fourth leading cause of death, actually the third leading worldwide. The mainstays of therapy are smoking cessation, oxygen vaccinations, rehab, and bronchodilators. If that seems like a weird order, it is. That is in descending order of proof of mortality benefit. So these three definitely help you live longer. There's some weak evidence that pulmonary rehab helps, but bronchodilators really haven't been shown to improve mortality. And then there are some advanced options already, lung volume reduction surgery and lung transplantation, but those are very specialized and require a very selected group of patients. There are three new therapies, either approved or in the pipeline. Bronchoscopic lung volume reduction, which is approved in the United States as of early last year. And then bronchial rheoplasty and targeted lung denervation, which are still investigational. So a little bit about endobronchial lung volume reduction. The theory is very similar to that of lung volume reduction surgery. You want to decrease hyperinflation of very diseased lung to allow moderately diseased lung to participate more in ventilation and gas exchange. Instead of a thoracotomy and a big resection, we deploy a couple of valves and close off the airflow to one or two lobes of the lung. Those lobes then collapse down, hyperinflation resolves, the diaphragm moves to its normal position, respiratory muscle work decreases, and ventilation and perfusion are better matched. Patients are able to breathe easier, they feel better, at least in theory. In practice, actually, turns out to be true. This is table 2 from the 2010 VENT trial. This was one of the studies that got these valves approved in the United States. And I put it up in this illegible format because I want you to look at two major things. And those are the primary endpoints. Those are lung function and symptoms. Those are not mortality. That said, their lung function got better. They were able to exercise more, and they felt better. The important other things to know about this, the effects were greatest in those without collateral ventilation. So people in whom air could sneak from the right lower lobe into the right upper lobe, those people didn't get a lot of benefit because the right upper lobes didn't really collapse. It makes sense. Mortality, interestingly, was not assessed because they weren't intending to power the trial for that. And even with lung volume reduction surgery, the mortality benefit was pretty minimal. And so in practice, these are the trial inclusion requirements on the left. The current practice at Pittsburgh and at other academic centers is very similar. You want people with minimal collateral flow, if any, and we use this proprietary system made by Pulmonics, the maker of the valves, to assess for that. You want people who are badly obstructed with a lot of hyperinflation, and people who are otherwise pretty okay. You know, they can exchange gases, they're not alpha-1 deficient, they don't have many other severe comorbidities. They can have some coronary disease, diabetes, but no like active decompensated heart failure, and generally no active malignancy. The second thing is what's called bronchoreaplasty. And so this is, now we're moving from the husband to the wife. The wife's symptoms are driven primarily by changes in her airways due to her, presumably, smoking history. Heavy smokers get a lot of metaplasia of their airways. They get a lot of enrichment of goblet cells, a lot of mucus production, and a lot of parasympathetically innervated effects on their airways. And the theory behind this is taken largely from bronchothermoplasty and asthma. If you kill the epithelium, it'll eventually grow back, and it'll actually grow back relatively normally. So this catheter is a little electrified cage. You literally just start zapping bronchi, and then once you've done a lung, you stop. You let the patient rest a month, and then you do the other side. This is very, very new, so the only data to support this practice, really, are from an abstract at the European Respiratory Society meeting last year. This was 25 patients, but they were able to show significant reductions in goblet cell hyperplasia, so these are histologic slides, and patients' dyspnea symptoms significantly improved. There was a high rate of exacerbation in the immediate post-procedural period, as you can expect. Somebody killed their airways, but afterwards, actually, exacerbation frequency dropped off dramatically. And a U.S. trial is ongoing. This is the clinicaltrials.gov entry here. And so the University of Pittsburgh is actually a participant in this trial. And so if people are referred, we can evaluate them for it. They need to have, as you would expect, chronic bronchitis, moderate severe obstruction, at least one exacerbation in the last year, some smoking history. And then, similarly, they can't be too sick, no active infection, they can't be on too much prednisone or other steroids. And then again, no decompensated heart failure, no active cancer. And then the last thing I'd like to talk about is targeted lung denervation. So, as I mentioned, the wife's symptoms, sort of chronic bronchitic symptoms, are parasympathetically mediated, by and large. And those parasympathetic nerves mediate smooth muscle tone, airway reactivity, and mucus production. They also, conveniently, run right along the outside of the airways. And so while you can target these pathways with antimuscarinics, what if there were a more permanent solution? And that is, in fact, targeted lung denervation. What's done is you put in a radiofrequency catheter, and you ablate in 90-degree arcs along each mainstem bronchus. You actually do this while you have a balloon in the esophagus to avoid backwards perforation of the esophagus for obvious reasons. You burn both at once, and then you let them go. The data here are based on an ongoing trial in Europe. This is Airflow 2. These data are based on about 80 patients who have been enrolled thus far. And as you can expect, there was some rate of procedural complications. They had more exacerbations in the first 3 months after the procedure. But thereafter, out to 12 months, exacerbation frequency dropped off dramatically. About a third of the intervention patients had an exacerbation versus three quarters of the controls. And their scores on the COPD assessment test and St. George's respiratory questionnaire also improved. There was some signal towards an effect on lung function, although it was probably similar to just staying on Spiriva. And in the practice here, this is also an ongoing trial in the United States, but we're looking for people with pretty bad obstruction, sort of moderately severe to severe, ideally not current smokers, people who are frequently exacerbating, and then similarly, not too sick, you know, other non-COPD lung disease, not on too much steroid. And so, to close, bronchoscopic lung volume reduction, you can think of as basically an advance in lung volume reduction. It's lung volume reduction surgery, but less invasive. And that's very appropriate for people with the classic emphysematous phenotype. Targeted lung denervation and rheoplasty are investigational therapies, but appear likely to be appropriate for more of a chronic bronchitic phenotype, people who are exacerbating frequently, going to the hospital a lot, coughing a lot. And that said, optimal medical therapy, pulmonary rehab, vaccinations are likely to remain the backbone of COPD care. You can make almost everybody better with those things. But we, and by we I mean Frank Sherba, are happy to help if anybody has any patients who might be trial participants. Thank you, and I'll take any questions.
Well, so Neil finished with 2 seconds to spare, so perfect timing. And we particularly want to thank him because generally, when we invite fellows to come give these talks, they're canned and vetted. But Neil went to the trouble of doing a second talk for us, which was it was particularly appropriate. It was wonderful. Are you standing up to say something, Terry? Oh, okay. I never know when you stand up. I'm always worried. What I'm going to ask is we're a little bit behind, mostly due to a timing schedule glitch in the schedule. So I'm going to ask, instead of being back at 3:10, which is, 3 minutes from now, we're back at 3:20. And so we'll take 5 minutes off the break. So we'll start up again at 3:20. Thanks to all of our speakers this afternoon.